Welcome to Cooper Talk. I'm your host, Steve Cooper, and remember, I'm only as hip as my guest. And I got to tell you something, people. There's not a lot of TV me and Joanne watch together, but we always make sure we watch Law & Order on the Thursdays, and my guest was on it. And what's funny is I reached out to him many years ago on Twitter because I knew of him, and I think at the time he was on Army Wives with Brian McNamara, who's been on the show. But I reached out to him because I was watching a rerun, and I can't remember what show it was, but he was down near the water, and I think he got killed. And I said, that guy, I like that guy. So I looked him up, and I hit him up on Twitter, and we communicated for a little bit, but then I think you were in South Carolina, and I don't know if I was still in L.A. recording it, or I was back east then. But anyway, my guest is Terry Serpico. How you doing, Terry?
Hey, good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are.
Now, do you remember? I can't think what show it was. I just remember you're down on a dock, and you got shot.
Oh yeah, down on a dock. Was it? Maybe it was that thing with Poppy Montgomery.
Oh yeah, yeah. Unforgettable. It was Unforgettable.
Maybe that was it. Yeah.
All right. So So I got to let's talk about Law & Order first. I want to talk about your career, but you've been on Law & Order, and you've. How did that role start, and when it started, was it, you know, you've been on a few different variations of Law & Order.
Yeah, I did. If you take the franchise as a whole, I've portrayed 7 different characters from in all the platforms, like from Criminal Intent to Special Victims Unit to The Mothership. But this one came about playing Chief of Detectives Tommy McGrath on the last few seasons of Special Victims Unit. I was up in Beacon, New York, standing in my garden, puttering around, and my agent called and says, "Where are you?" Because at the time I was kind of splitting myself between South Carolina and New York. And I said, "Well, I'm in the garden." And she says, no, what state? I said, "Oh, okay, well, I'm in New York." She says, can you be in the city in an hour? They want to COVID test you. And I was like, no, I can't be in the city in an hour, but I can be there in like 3 hours. And she's like, "All right, let me get back to you." She calls me back. She says, "All right, yeah, can you get down there? And because they want you to start working tomorrow." I was like, "Wait, who's they?" Right. "Oh, it's Law & Order Special Victims Unit. They, you know, they had somebody who actually caught COVID, somebody who was in the role, who contracted COVID and was unable to work." And this was in the midst of our COVID joy and wonder. And so I went down there and I tested, and I went back the next day, went to work. And it was supposed to have been a couple episodes, you know, where I was playing the Chief of Detectives, and we were running our the current head of SVU, Damore Barnes, I think, played the role. I forget the character's name, but he had run afoul of the administration somehow, and so I was the administration that he had run afoul of. And so it was supposed to have been a couple episodes where they kind of moved him along and brought someone else in, and then I just I stayed. I refused to leave, and so they found things for me to do.
Now that you said they called and it was an offer. Now, at your point in your career, do you get mostly offers or do you still audition? Because I know people like that still, like Patrick Fabian, he still auditions, and he was on Better Call Saul, who you probably ran into on auditions all the time in L.A., But do you still audition, or are you getting all offers now?
God, I wish I could say it was offers, but no, sir. I audition the way I always have. You know, you go and your agent sends you an audition request, and you know, should you accept the assignment? You know, this is your mission. And so my agent sends me the submission. Audition requests, and I try to fulfill those requests as best as I possibly can, do the best work that I can between my wife and myself. The vast majority of the time at this stage of the game in this industry is self-tapes at home. So, you know, we move the living room furniture around, you know, make room and hang the backdrop on the wall and set up the cameras and the lights and do the whole 9 yards. But very rarely, even still, very rarely is it just a straight offer. Occasionally, if it's the kind of guy that I have made a living playing, and you know, hopefully we all know what that is, but I generally have that kind of asshole-y command presence, which thankfully I'm pleased to say I get out all of that in my work. That's not me personally by any stretch of the imagination, really. Although I must have my moments, I guess we all do. But yeah, so I taped them at home, and you know, kind of as is the nature of the business, kind of go with hat in hand and say, okay, here's the work that I've done. Do you want me to do it on your show? You
know. Now personally, and I've asked a lot of actors this, and there's different answers. Do you prefer in room? A lot of actors who've been around for a while like the in room because that's how they came out. Because there was another, you know, a long time ago. And then, you know, but some of them do like the self-tape, but they always like the spot noted being in a room with the producers. What do you prefer? I mean, because you've gone on a ton of auditions, but what do you like better?
Oh, goodness. I guess I'd have to say at this point that I like the self-tape better, because that is the industry standard at this point. And also, you do have the luxury of being able to prepare at your leisure, given if you're given enough time to prepare the material. You don't have to travel to get there, so there's that stress element is removed. You don't have to worry about getting there on time. You don't have to sit there in the waiting room for 2 hours because they're running behind. You don't have to deal with other actors who are pacing in front of you learning their lines or you know, doing their shtick. And then you get more than one crack at it, which, you know, when you're in the room, you can generally say, like, can I try that again? And they're more than willing, because everybody wants you to do well. And they want you to do well on self-tapes as well. So I find that I like self-tapes a little better at this point. And it may just be because I haven't had an in-person in so long. I always enjoy auditioning. I still enjoy the audition process because it gives me and my wife an opportunity to work a little bit together and to kind of do a little bit of work. It's, you know, it's something to do. And the exploration is joyful, but, I'm not sure that I miss, traveling to get to, small little rooms, to stand on the other side of a desk and try to impress somebody.
Now you met your wife on Law and Order, right?
We did. We met on the set of Special Victims Unit.
Now I want to hear this, because it's funny. You just said I always play an asshole-y character. So she probably didn't. I mean, I don't know if she knew you before, but she's probably like, man, this guy's an asshole. And you know, tell me, how did you guys meet? I mean, this is great. How did you guys meet?
It was in a scene. We were in a scene together. I was giving a press conference, as was the common occurrence with Tommy McGrath. And so I'm standing at a podium speaking to the press, and then I pass the mic to my colleague, Olivia Benson. So I step back to let Mariska into the podium, and as I step back, I step on this young lady's foot. I literally stepped on her foot. And, you know, we call cut. And eventually, and so I had the opportunity to apologize for stepping on her foot. Had I not had that reason to speak to her, I probably would not have said a thing, because I have zero game, and she's just gorgeous. And I was, you know, kind of flabbergasted and flummoxed. But we started talking in between takes and in between setups, and we had a lovely conversation. This was still during COVID, so masks were on and stuff. But at one point, I kind of stepped back and I took my mask down, because there was just something. I just wanted her to see me, not to try and impress her with all that is me, because it ain't all that. But I just wanted her to see me. And I think I still want her to see me every day, you know, just the real me. At any rate, at the end of the day, she just fucked off. She just disappeared. It's like I meant nothing. At any rate, I found out her contact information through her manager, and I left an email with her manager saying, hey, look, I just met your client today on set. We had a lovely conversation. I'd like to continue that conversation. Here is my information should she like to get in touch with me. And Katia got back to me a few days later and said, Oh, well, it was nice to talk to you. Thanks for getting in touch. You know, it was kind of like a very so it took us a little time to get to the point where she said, "Okay, give me a call." Because I texted back and forth a couple of times. I'm like, "Oh, dear." So I call her and she says, "Look, I had asked her out. She wants to go have a drink." She says, "I don't drink." Okay. "I don't date people on set." Okay. "And I'm not interested in getting into a relationship." Okay. "I'm down with that." I was like, "Okay, anything else?" So we dated about a month later, and then she went to visit her family in Europe, and came back, and we started dating in earnest, and then we were married within the year.
That's awesome. You know, you said about pandemic. Me and my wife got married, and 6 months later, we went into lockdown. And it was one of those things, you know, it was like,
Oh, wow.
thank God we've been together for a while, and she moved to LA with me, and then we moved back. But it was weird. I could just imagine what it would be like dating during COVID. I mean, as you said, you have a mask on you. People can't see you. I mean,
Right.
it must have been very an odd time. Like, we were confined to the condo, and we were fine with that, so we
Right.
got along. But it must have been a weird time if you were unattached at that moment.
Well, this was as COVID was kind of releasing its grasp to an extent. We were starting to, and certainly on set when you're filming, the masks come off. So, but COVID was starting to wane at that point. So when we started dating, it was kind of masks optional at that point. So we were able to kind of get good looks at each other, and that's why it happened so fast. By most people's standards, we moved very quickly. By our own standards, we moved very deliberately. We asked very pointed. Once we got to the point where we realized, okay, there's no major red flags here.
Right.
Let's go ahead and is it okay if we fall in love with each other? Oh, yeah, okay, let's do that. And that it was a process of asking some very pointed and particular questions because we'd both been there before. We'd both been married and divorced, both have kids. It was, and so we felt pretty comfortable that we knew what we were getting into with one another. And yet there's still some mystery because we're still getting to know each other. So there's a I'm just, oh my goodness, I am just so grateful that, it's like the creator was like, "Dude, she's right there. Do I have to have you trip over her to see her? She's right there. Right behind you, right behind." And I tripped her.
So,
I'll take it from here.
you've been acting for a long time. How did you get into
Yeah.
acting? Now, I saw somewhere. Were you a military brat?
I was an army brat, yes, sir.
Okay, so I want to ask you: do you think that's one of the reasons why you may have gotten into acting? Because you probably moved a lot, and whenever you go to a new school, it's like you're auditioning, because people don't know you. I mean, how many schools did you go through from elementary to high school?
Oh, geez. Let me see. I made six moves between when I was born and when I got to high school. So that must have been at least four or five different schools of some sort, whether from nursery school or elementary school to middle school and then high school. But yeah, I was born in Fort Sill, Oklahoma. Moved to Fort Bliss in El Paso, Texas. Moved to Fort Carson in Boulder, Colorado, or Colorado Springs. Moved to Peden Barracks in West Germany. Then moved to Fort McPherson in Atlanta, which is now Tyler Perry Studios. Then we moved to Malvern, Pennsylvania. And my father retired at that point. And immediately took a job overseas. He didn't know how to be home very well. And so I was fortunate enough to be able to go to junior high and high school in the same school system. My brother and sister, both older, both went to two apiece. So I mean, moving in the middle of your junior high or high school years is difficult to say the least, and they had to do it twice. So I grew up in it. I say my hometown is pretty much Malvern, Pennsylvania, which is west of Philly. And it was there in my sophomore year. My freshman year, I went to see the school musical. And I was a three sports a year athlete. I mean, all year athlete. Whatever, anything that had a ball or a racket or a glove, or I was on it, you know. I would. And I went to see the musical, and there were, like, it looked like they were having a great time. And there were like, cute girls on stage in leotards and stuff. And I thought, wow, that's great. And I bet they have great parties. So the next year, I auditioned for the show, the musical, and I got the role of Snoopy in You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. So I was, like, up to my neck in theater. And I found my tribe. And eventually, you know, I balanced sports and theater through high school. But by the time I was a senior, I was full on doing theater, and we did, you know, all the shows from the musicals to, I did choreography, I did set design, construction. I was just like in it, you know. And then went to Boston University for a couple of years, right out of high school. Got cut from their program. It was a kind of, there's a group of schools around the country. I'm not sure if the league still exists, but it was the League of Professional Theater Training Programs. And part of their MO was that they would reduce the student numbers every year in their conservatory environment to try to increase their student to teacher ratio, and, you know, make it a smaller company moving forward year after year. Either way, I was on the outs at BU after my sophomore year. Kicked around Europe for a while, came back, and went to SUNY Purchase and got my degree from SUNY. Graduated in '89 with my BFA and moved to the big city.
Now, when you were in college, did you know this was going to be your career path? Because, you know, it's sometimes people will go for acting and then they get out and they go, holy shit, this is really hard. You know, they don't expect it, because in school a lot of time they don't tell you, hey, here's what you have to do. They don't tell you how to get an agent or how to deal with the rejection. So, I mean,
no, they don't.
Exactly. So a lot of times, like, I think a lot of people will go to school thinking, you know, let's say they get into a good program, and they're like, oh, this is a cakewalk. Oh, man, I'm, you know, and then all of a sudden they get in the real world, and they go, I can't get an agent. What am I going to do? When did you know you wanted it to be your, when you went to college, did you say, I'm going to be an actor, or, and you weren't going to look back, or did you have second thoughts, or what?
Oh, man. When I chose to go to school for acting, it was a ridiculously unconscious decision. I don't know what I was thinking, quite honestly. I had been doing this in high school, and it really flipped my switch. And I just, so when I started looking for colleges, I was just looking for theater training programs. I didn't really make a conscientious effort to say, okay, this is what I want to do. I'm going to be an actor. I'm going to pursue this, and I'm going to be, you know, the next big star. It was just like, oh, this is what I'm doing. Okay. And I continued to go along in that thoughtless kind of la-da-da-da-da-da-da, just stumbling down the road until I graduated SUNY Purchase. And then I, you know, realized that, well, at that point, when I graduated SUNY, we had this kind of presentation at the end of our training, at the end of 4 years. So all the league schools would kind of send their graduating classes to New York. And we would do a performance. We would do a presentation for an invited audience of agents and managers and producers and whomever wanted to come to see the new crop of talent from these exclusive, rigorous training programs. So it wasn't a bad place for somebody looking for talent to go, right? So I came out of that. I was fortunate, as most of us were in those programs, to come out of that with offers from agents. So I chose to go with Abrams Artists, which was now A3, and I believe A3 is no longer as of a couple of few weeks ago. It kind of imploded. But I was with Abrams for a little while, and then got dropped by Abrams, and then was with them and them and them and them, and bounced around until eventually I ended up with Don Buchwald and Associates, and I've been with them for, almost 20 years, maybe.
Now, when did you start getting work? I mean, you know, you look at your IMDb and it shows you're in, you know, in Copland and you're all these movies. But when did you start actually getting work where you knew you get your SAG card? I mean, when did you get your SAG card on a gig, or how did you get your SAG card?
I did. I traded my SAG card for my services on Donnie Brasco in 1997. The money that I made to do that movie went to pay for my dues membership, basically. It was just like, it was almost like an even trade at the time. But that was 97. I had gotten out of school in 89. So those intervening years were what it took me to get to a point where I booked my first major film. And it's been trying to book ever since, doing whatever work I have to do, working on my audition technique, working on everything, just plugging away ever since. But once I got out of school in 89 and I had some representation, and I bounced around a little bit through reps, and I booked some soap operas that were still working at that time in New York, which dates me. And I booked some, you know, some small stuff, but nothing major. And I was tending bar at the time. I was, you know, busy tending bar, and I met my first wife, and, you know, it was just, got to a point where it's like, you know what, just screw this. I'm not doing this. I just want to go live on the beach and raise babies, you know, hell with this. And then I booked Donnie Brasco, and I was like, you know what, I came here to do this. So let's give this the shot that it deserves, because I'd hate to have that toxic what if, you know, simmering under the rest of my life. So I think one of the things that really moved the needle in the direction of staying in the industry was the fact that I met George Aguilar, who was the stunt coordinator on Donnie Brasco. And in the scene with Al Pacino and Johnny Depp, and I get to say that, my first scene in a major movie was with Al Pacino and Johnny
Depp. Wow. And when you think back, yeah, I mean, it's funny. You know, when you think back, and it's like when I talk to some people who said, oh, I was in these pilots and didn't get picked up. And I'm like, but you were in those pilots. I mean, like for you, even if you never acted again, just to be able to sit there and look back and go, oh, yeah, I was in a movie with a scene. And people are like, oh, yeah, you're full of crap. And like, oh, no. And they watch it. They go, oh, my God, Terry, you were in that scene.
Yeah, I was. It was Fugazi. Hey, hey, what's a Fugazi? Yeah, Pacino, man, I went in and I was one of the New York actors that was able to come to his office in the pre-production stage and read through the script with him and John and you know, various other actors. And Pacino first met me, and he's not feeling well. He's got the flu or something. He comes up to me and says, is that really your name? Like, yeah, that's my name. You know, it's like, look at me. Would I change my name to Serpico if I was going to change it to something? But I told him, it's like, you're like an honorary member of the family, man, you know, because he played Serpico all those years ago. And then Sidney Lumet. And then I got to work with Sidney Lumet again years later. And worked with him several times. But yeah, I met George Aguilar on the set of Donnie Brasco. I was getting my ass kicked in that scene. And he's like, you get your ass kicked really well, man. You should give me your resume. I'll get you some work. And he booked me on just about everything he could after that. I became one of his stunt players in his stable of guys and girls. And so I got to do a bunch of like big movies from behind the velvet rope. I got in through back door, you know, as a stunt player. And it turns out that it was a nice little niche of like a stunt player who could act, who could deliver lines. So, you know, a lot of that would fall to me. And so I was able to kind of pad my resume and start building a reel and start understanding the, you know, how sets work and the etiquette of it and how to apply my craft while still, you know, being a good team player. And, so I'm very grateful to George and to the other members of the stunt community that became my friends and mentors.
Now, was there ever a time that you thought about just going full blown stunt? Because, you know, if it's as I said, it's, you know, you're in with this guy, you're good at what you do, and you know how to act. So you have a certain level, and it's work. I mean, bottom line is, you know, you're going to always work. So did you ever sit there and go, I think I might just stop following the acting and just follow the stunt, because I can move up the ladder and maybe end up being a stunt coordinator? Did that ever cross your mind?
It certainly did. Yeah, it certainly did. There was a period of time there when I thought maybe I'd go to my friend Blaze Corrigan who's a stunt coordinator and was George's right hand for a long time, and say, "Hey, Blaze, you know, like kind of learn me up here. Let's follow that." It's hard on the body. It's stunt work is supposed to look dangerous, not be dangerous, but you can still get pretty banged up. And I took a couple of knocks and it's like, okay, maybe this isn't a long-term job prospect. And also at that point, things started to move on the acting front. So it became apparent that my energies kind of needed to go there. You know, there's still days when I think, geez, maybe I should have just become a stunt coordinator. I'd still be, you know, going to the mailbox and pulling checks from all those movies that I, you know, had a hand in. I think I imagined for years that so many of these stunt players that you see, you know, sometimes I can see them in movies and I'm like, oh, somebody, he's going to get punched in the face. You watch, because I know that guy and he always gets punched in the face. But he goes to his mailbox and there's just stuff full of residuals because of all the movies that they've done.
When I lived in L.A., I actually met a guy at a bar who was a stuntman, but he had a stunt horse. And he said, there's not a lot of them, so the horse knew how to take a fall. And he goes, the horse gets paid more than me. He said, when you watch the movies, he goes, there's not that many people who have, and it fascinated me, because I'm like, so someone sat there and trained this horse to take a fall, and the horses get more work than the owner. And the owner's probably like, geez, it's better his body than mine.
I'd met, like stunt players who used to be cops or something like that and said, you know, I got more money pretending to be a cop than being a cop. And, you know, people don't shoot real bullets at me in this job.
Exactly. So you're acting. When do you feel that your career is starting to get momentum? I know you were recurring on Rescue Me, but what was like the job that you sat there and said, I'm feeling good about this?
I'm still waiting for that job. You know, I wish that was funny. I think that's kind of the curse of the actor in so many ways, is that we're always waiting for that sense of security, that sense that, oh, okay, I've made it, or you know, I don't have to worry at this point. It's still a hat in hand industry, but in answer to the question, probably Army Wives was a huge turning point for me, to book a show and then to become a series regular on that show really moved me several rungs up the Catch-22 ladder, and gave me the confidence after, you know, over 100 episodes to really kind of start growing up as an actor and learning the lessons that the industry had been trying to teach me for so long.
What do you mean when you say that, growing up as an actor?
Well, I was trained in the theater, and for the longest time, I was trying to apply what I believed was my job, trying to do my job, which is to essentially deliver my lines in the same fashion, on the same mark, every night, so that my co-stars and my fellow actors could depend on me to know that that line comes out when I pick up that letter opener and, you know, that kind of thing. So I was working quite a bit, but still kind of got caught in my ideas of what needed to be in that performance. It wasn't until... Geez, I don't even know when, but it always feels like a lesson I just learned, which is my job as a film and television actor is to give the editors a bunch of stuff to work with. You know, before I was trying to do the best performance from action to cut, you know, and, you know, have it all be there. And it's like, you know what? It's not all in there. It's all in all the takes. And then they will determine what all of it is. So it took me a while to grow up as an actor and realize that my job is to provide footage for the editor.
Now, how did Army Wives come? Good, sorry.
when I see young actors now and I see them on set, and they, you know, that often is the case with guest stars and stuff on Special Victims or various other shows. I always try to impart that a little bit. It's like, look, your job is to just give them a different take each time. Don't change your intention so much. Don't try and change the language. Just change how you come into it and see where it goes, so that you're providing the editors with options, because they love options.
So how did Army Wives come about?
Curiously enough, Army Wives was an audition request. It came across my desk just like anything else. It's like you know, Marcy Phillips over at ABC wants to audition you for this role. And I read the breakdown and everything, and I'm like, hard-ass Army officer. I know that guy. I was raised by that guy, you know? The dude's name was even Frank. My dad's name is Frank. He was a hard-ass Army major, and my dad, before he was a hard-ass Army colonel, was a hard-ass Army major. So I was like, I got this. So it was an in-person audition. I went in and I read with Marcy, and she thought it was great. I felt pretty damn comfortable about it. And then I got a call from my agent. It's like, oh, they'd love to fly you out to L.A. to do a screen test for this show. Very exciting. So I flew out to L.A. and they put me up, and I went and did a screen test. They're more of like a chemistry read. I'd forgotten this very important element of the story, which was when I got out there, they said, okay, we'd like you to read for the role of the general instead of, you know, Frank Sherwood. I forget. Geez, it's been so long now, I've forgotten the general's name, the part that Brian McNamara played. At any rate, so I do this little chemistry read with Kim Delaney. And I thought it went really well. And I go back to my hotel and I get a call from my agent saying, oh, well, Terry, I'm sorry, but it's just not going to go any further. They just, you know, just not. So I did what any reasonable person would do, is I got drunk and I threw myself around my hotel room in despair and self-loathing. I woke up with these unexplainable bruises, and I just and my agent calling me saying, hey, the reason it wasn't going any further with that one is because they saw you so clearly as Major Sherwood that they just want to cast you in that. And I'm like, what? You know, lucky that I didn't punch holes in the walls and, you know, owed the hotel money. I'm like, why didn't you tell me that before I have this massive headache? So I was fortunate enough to get to play Catherine Bell's husband for 7 seasons on Army Wives at that point. Moved down to Charleston, South Carolina. Major changes occurred in my life at that time. I got separated and then divorced and moved to South Carolina, and you know, all the attendant kind of confusion and whatnot as a result of all that.
Now, what is it like as an actor when, you know, when did you know after every season, when did you know you were getting picked up for the next season? Because as it says, you know, when you become a series regular, you know you have that check coming in. You know you have a job to go to. So with Army Wives, was it originally, when did you know during the seasons when you were getting picked up? Because you ran for a long time.
It did. We were fortunate enough to run for 7 seasons, which is really rarefied air. We're in very good company of shows that have run that long. When I first booked the show, they booked me as a recurring role. But I think that when they first started the show, they assumed it was going to be driven primarily by the storyline of the wives, hence Army Wives. But without the husbands, the context of the soldiers, without the context of the soldiers and spouses that are serving, the Army Wives lacked punch. So they brought the men into the story more, the soldiers more into the story. So the second season, I became a series regular. And so I had to move down to South Carolina basically to be available to shoot. My family still lived in New York. So after season 2, we got a quick, or, you know, in the middle of season 2, we got a pickup for season 3, and it's like, great. So I was like, well, I'll move my family down to South Carolina, 'cause we're going to be down here shooting this thing. And then the end of season three, we didn't get a pickup. We didn't get a pickup, and we didn't get a pickup, and I'm sitting there looking at my wife, and I'm like, what are we going to do? So we moved the family back to Beacon, and then we got picked up. And so I moved back to South Carolina. And, you know, this business, like the Army, can be hard on marriages, so that's not the business that rendered that asunder. There were various other elements involved. We generally got the pickup on that show while we were either still shooting or just after we had finished shooting. Because I think they wanted to make sure that they kept everybody locked in. And then there was one season, I forget what season it was, where they weren't sure if we were going to get picked up again. So they paid us extra to extend the season for 10 episodes. And that became the beginning of the next season, what might have been the entire next season. And then it just disappeared. It's like we shot season seven. We brought in a bunch of new faces, as the Army does, so it makes perfect sense. Some of the original cast had cycled out, and we brought in some new faces, and it was going relatively well. But then Lifetime changed hands in terms of ownership. I think it went from ABC to Disney or something. I'm not exactly sure, but it happened at a corporate level. And regardless of the success of Army Wives, I think the new ownership wanted to imprint their own kind of DNA on the new Lifetime, the rebranding. And so we did not get picked up. We did not continue. And there really was, it was kind of left in the air. There was no real closure to the show. There wasn't the writing that would support that, okay, this is going to be the series ender, anything like that. And honestly, I think that show could probably still be going today. Because, you know, I grew up in the military. Every 3 years you moved. Your dad got stationed somewhere else and they brought somebody else in who lived in your house, you know? So it would have been easy enough to just have this kind of rotating cast or this moving cast and just continue to mine the experience of growing up in the armed forces and bringing that to the screen. I think that's one of the things we did so successfully was to show what it is that the families go through being married to the Army.
Now, do you hit some depression after that? Because it's like your family. You moved down there. You've been with these people for seven seasons, so you know the crew. You know, you know the crafty person. You know the all that. So you get to know them, and I've talked to people who said it's like a family. You feel like a family because everyone's in a good mood because their jobs are secure. It's not like you're walking on eggshells. So when it comes, when it hits you, it smacks you right in the ass. Mm-hmm. Out of nowhere, what did you go through? I mean, was it something? Were you pissed? Were you upset? Because, as you said, it could have been going for a long time, and you know the military life, so you know it more than the actual people who are from the network. You know how it works.
It was upsetting, to say the least. I mean, you get very used to having a job, and you forget what it is to be continually without one. And we were all down there in Charleston, which is a beautiful town. And we were all like just kind of perennially on location. We became one another's friends and playmates and cohorts, and we'd golf together and go bowling together and we'd do, you know, have picnics together. We hung out a lot. And of course we got to know all the crew cause they were local. So when the show left town, I stayed, I had at that point I had fallen in love with this woman and, you know, while my entire life used to fit in my Volvo station wagon, all of a sudden I'm buying furniture. So things changed for me. And then I booked another show called The Inspectors, which was actually shooting in Charleston, which is surprising since Army Wives was the only game in town while we were there. And The Inspectors was basically the only game in town while we were there. But this was a Saturday morning educational and informational, like, kids show. It's called The Inspectors. It's based on the Postal Inspection Service, which is the oldest federal law enforcement agency in the country. It grew out of the Pony Express. And the post office apparently had a relationship with the producer. He had done some public service spots for them or something. And so they went to him and they said, look, we spend all this money every year making these posters to put up in the post offices to explain to people the various things that can be of danger to them in the mail and what they should and shouldn't do and things like that. How about if we give you that money that we're spending on these damn posters that nobody reads and we make a TV program? And we, you know, we do a half hour procedural about stuff that the Postal Inspection Service wants people to know. And so we did that for 4 seasons, and I directed 7 of those episodes. It was a half-hour light family procedural. It was it was scripted. It was a very odd kind of bird to have on CBS on a Saturday morning. But it did pretty well. I got a daytime Emmy nomination for it, and it won several daytime Emmys for, you know, it was good programming. And then that just disappeared. They just packed us up at the end of season 4 because we had to vacate the studio space. It had been leased to someone else. And they're like, all right, we'll just pack it up and put it in the shipping containers, and we'll store it, and then we'll move it to wherever we end up, and we just never heard again. So,
What made you decide to direct? Did they ask you, or is it something that you had wanted to do?
When they first approached me about doing The Inspectors, they wanted me to be the very similar to the character I play now, the guy that shows up in a big black car, yells at everybody to do their job, and then leaves. You know, and I was like, yeah, okay, I can do that. That sounds great. But I want to direct. Yeah, that's it. You know, it's like, I'll do it, but I'm going to direct. It's like, okay. And then, they started working on the episodes, and they came back and asked me if I'd play one of the leads. And I said, sure. But, the directing stuck. So I managed to kind of cut my teeth on 7 episodes of that show, which was a trial by fire because it was a half-hour show, and by the time we got into our third season, they were giving us 2.5 days to shoot 1 episode. So there were days when I would shoot 11 scenes. I mean, just flying. And guest stars would come in, mostly from Atlanta, and I'd say, look, just so you know, we move very quickly. So if I've got it, I am moving on. It's no reflection on you. If you desperately feel like you need another take, let me know. But if I feel like I've got it, I've got to move on because I've got 7 other scenes to shoot before lunch. You know, yeah. Like that kind of shit.
So after that, you know, you look at your IMDb. You've worked on some really, through your career, some great shows. But in the last, you know, years, Designated Survivor. How did that role come about? And you're working with Kiefer. I mean, what is that like for you?
Well, Designated Survivor was a real was really sweet because Jeff Melvoin, who was the showrunner on Army Wives, became the showrunner on Designated Survivor, and I had shot him an email one day just because we'd become friendly enough to be able to email back and forth. And I was like, you know, how you doing? What's going on? You know? And he said, why don't you audition for the show? And so they sent me an audition for Designated Survivor, and I booked it, and I ended up doing like 7 or 8 episodes of that. Was very fortunate to get an opportunity to travel up to Toronto and shoot that. The way the show was set up, the way my character was set up in the storyline, I didn't work with Kiefer. I was always like in some bunker somewhere. I was always the guy they couldn't find, you know? So I spent a lot of time with me on set alone. Also at the time, geez, I had my knee was all blown out. So I was hobbling around on crutches for a good part of that.
Was that from doing stunts or how'd you blow your knee out?
I think I was running and I just hit a low spot and my hyperextended and just went and squished my meniscus, you know.
Well, now,
Both of my knees operated on, yeah.
Now the also Yellowstone. Tell me about your experience on Yellowstone, because these are popular shows you're on.
These are big shows. These are big shows. I've been very, very, very fortunate to work on some of the shows that I've worked on with some of the people that I've worked on. There's no doubt about that. Yellowstone again was an audition that was sent to me as an audition request, a self tape, and I think they booked me before they booked. Why do I always blank on the man who played my brother, Neil McDonough, who's got these big bright blue eyes and is just that intense dude. What a wonderful man too, really sweet. That was an audition that went my way, and so I got an opportunity to work with Kevin Costner and Cole Hauser. My God, he's just so perfect for that role at Rip, just unbelievable. And we were shooting in Park City, Utah, the second season, which is the season that I was in. Me and Neil McDonough played brothers who were trying to take the Dutton Ranch from Kevin Costner's character and his family, which was a no-no. They dealt with us in the way they dealt with all their other problems, which was generally just shoot first and ask questions later. It's just great storytelling, beautiful place to shoot. My sister actually lives in Park City, so I got to see her quite a bit. We shot up in Montana as well. It was a great experience. I love being in the mountains. I would love to actually live out that way, but my life is here in New York.
Well, you're getting these parts, though, and you're getting a little bit of a run, like Flight Attendant. How did that come about? Because once again, you're getting these. It's like you're on the precipice of, like, you probably sit there and go, just make me a goddamn series regular, or just give me a role to put it instead of casting me for something that's going to recur. You know me. Just give me the series regular. But Flight Attendant, what was your experience on that show?
There was a period of time there when I was shooting the Flight Attendant, Mosquito Coast, Homeland, and Hightown, all at the same time as recurring guest star. And I don't know, man, it'd be great if they just start casting me as a series regular. I would love that. In fact, that's my plan at this point, if anybody's listening. Flight Attendant was again, it was an audition that went my way. I got an audition, put in a self-tape. Actually, I think I did that one in person, now that I think about it. That might have been one of my last in-person auditions. Because that was just before COVID. Because our second season, they shot that for a part of that first season in Thailand. And I think, like, Rosie got COVID in Thailand or something like that very, very early on. At any rate, that was, just an audition that came my way through my agency, and it went my way. Same with Hightown, same with Mosquito Coast, there have been a couple episodes here and there where I've just gotten an offer where, the agent will call and say, hey, I've got an offer for you. Fantastic. What is it? Well, it's this asshole who comes in and yells at people and then gets back in his big black car and goes home. Oh, okay. Yeah, it's a one-episode guest star spot with a possible recurring. Oh, okay. It's more money than I had yesterday.
Now tell me about Cobra Kai, because that's an intense scene. And, dude, you're jacked in that scene. Like, you're ripped. Like, I guess it worked for you because you know stunts. But take me through that scene, because it's a physical scene, and I didn't know then that you did stunts. But, did you have to, like, are you always that ripped, or did you just, like, get ripped?
I've always been athletic. In fact, I look at that footage from Cobra Kai and I was like, oh my God, I was carrying around so much weight in that. I've actually lost about 20 pounds since then. And now I box every morning. But I had taken karate many years ago when my son was young. And I was taking him to karate, and I was like, well, I can't just sit around and do nothing. I'll do it too. But I got like a second belt. I went from yellow to orange or something. I never, kind of pursued that. But when Cobra Kai came across my desk, I was like, what is this? You got to be kidding me. I thought it was just kind of silly. And so I said, yeah, but it looks like fun. I'll do the audition. So again, I did an audition. It went my way. They decided to cast me in that role. It wasn't an offer. I got there. We were shooting in Atlanta. And we were on set. And they said, okay, well, let's go find some space and work out the choreography. It's like, okay. So... they choreographed this whole fight scene on the bridge there, in the space of about, we rehearsed it for about a half an hour, and then it basically went up there and did it. And I suppose it's through the trickery of camera angles and things like that it looked as good as it did. I think the fact that I'm pretty athletic and had some karate prior to. And when I knew that I was going to do that, a fight scene, I went into a friend of mine at the gym that I worked out, and we spent 2 hours just kind of refreshing, some stuff in case so I didn't look like a total fool. And it came out looking really great. And I had no idea that Cobra Kai was such a popular thing or that it would garner the attention that it did. But people love that show. And it's remarkable how well written it is and how they managed to take that iconic movie, the movie series and those characters, and then to bring them forward in time like that. It's really a testament to some very creative people. And I've been very, very proud to have been a part of it and that people identify with it so much.
Now, back to SVU. Are you done? Are you done on that show? Because the last time we saw you, you had a gun on Doogie Howser's best friend, son.
Yeah, right.
It's like it was like a total breakdown. Like you and that's the thing about the character. You are a hard ass, but they address that you had some anger issues. They address that stuff. But then at the end, that's the last thing. I mean, me and my wife were saying, he might freak a little. We never thought you were going to come out running out with a gun. I mean, we never thought you'd like be freaking out. But, I mean, did you know that was coming up? Like, what was the build-up to you sitting there all of a sudden getting, in trouble?
Well, I got a call, and they said, look, we're not writing you out. But, okay. Your character is going to go through something here that's going to get him in trouble with the administration within the police department, and he's gonna get demoted. I said, okay. And while I have not heard personally if I've actually been demoted or not, I know that the character my character was like the acting head of SVU Manhattan. So I was the Olivia's Uber boss as well as just her immediate supervisor. Well, that immediate supervisorship has gone to another character at this point. I think I don't know if she's already been introduced or if she's coming up. And what happens with my character, I honestly don't know. I really don't. I'm assuming that I'm done. But this was only supposed to have been a couple episodes in the first place, so I have no idea.
Now, because you're on these shows, do you get recognized a lot? I mean, or do you get like that? Are you that guy? I mean, because you've been on popular shows, and I'm sure Cobra Kai, everyone watched it, but probably a group of young kids now know of you because they're like,
right.
Oh yeah. And you know how it is, and flight attendants, a different demographic than Law and Order. I mean, you've you've gone over a lot of different demographics. Army wives is different than designated survivor. So you really play to a wide audience. Do you get recognized a lot?
I do. Not a ton. And also living in New York, I think people are, you know, they mind their own business. You can see the look of recognition in people's eyes. Sometimes you see somebody that's just like, oh, or will literally say something. And I'm always kind of touched that people want to reach out. And that means that they've made a connection that, and they just want to kind of acknowledge that connection. And that's great. That's one of the beautiful things of our industry. I recognized in airports. It happened quite a lot for Army Wives because the fan base there was so dedicated to those characters that I would get accosted for being mean to my wife on that show or for saying, you know, I can't believe you said that to her. It's like, lady, it's not me, you know, it's my character. Okay, never mind. You know, can't believe you've got her on a sex schedule. How dare you? I'm like, it's not me.
That always cracks me up when people, you know, there's been a story where people like try to beat up James Garner during the Rocker Files to see if he's really a tough guy. It's like, no, I write this. Now, in your career, what character that you've played are you most proud of? Is there one that you are very proud of? I mean, you've played so many great characters.
Well, I got to tell you, Frank Sherwood from Army Wives is right up there. I got an opportunity to play my dad. In so many ways, but to be able to play a soldier, a U.S. Army soldier who had such high moral and ethical character and was just trying to do the right things with his family and do his duty to his country, I was very proud of that. And working in that capacity as Frank Sherwood, I think, made me a better person. There's a movie that I shot called Mine 9 about coal miners and a coal mining disaster, an explosion that occurs underground, and we get trapped. That was a really rigorous, short, independent film shoot. And it was, you know, I was the number one on the call sheet, so I was carrying that burden. But I feel very proud of that particular piece. It was quite an undertaking. I'm very, very proud of the way that came out. I think Yellowstone was some good work. See, I really thought that my work in Hightown was pretty good, but that I loved doing the Boston dialect, so that was great. I love doing dialect work; that's always so much fun. Boy, there's things I wish I had to do over again, you know, like going back to Donnie Brasco and all those years ago. But hell, I was young, and what a great opportunity that was. And I worked with Pacino another couple of times after that.
Now, you know. There's the things you're proud of. When you look back at your career, what are some things that are just you instill in your memory? Like you go, holy crap. Like, I mean, working with Pacino and Depp on your first movie is like a, oh, wow, holy shit moment. But what is just something that made you, that you look back and go, no matter the rejection, no matter what an actor goes through, is people don't know, like actors have it harder than any salesman out there. Like you guys go through audition, but looking back, what has made this, your career path, made it a few things that just has made it worth it? Worth be able to say at the end of the day, I'm a working actor, and this is what I do. There's been ups and downs, but what did you look back and say, man, this makes it all worthwhile?
Being able to say that I'm a working actor and that I've been able to support my family for all these years as a working actor. But there were, for instance, during Army Wives, there were a couple of times when two two times I can remember where a woman approached me and said, your show really helped us get through our son's funeral. Because their sons both happened to have been in the service and were killed in the line of duty. And that really strikes you. And it really, really struck me that this is, this industry, this business touches people in a way that, cannot be underestimated and cannot be trivialized. It has to be given respect and it has to be given reverence to a certain degree, because it's, while we're used to kind of playing in the realm of the emotional as actors, for the general public, if they connect to the material, they connect to us, they connect to the storyline on an emotional level, then that is an honor, and that has to be given its due respect. I think moments like that, just moments, you know, it's like when you're standing on, years ago with, after a Sidney Lumet movie, Find Me Guilty, when Vin Diesel came out. It was a true story about mobsters who were being tried under the RICO Act, and one of the mobsters decided to defend himself and was actually quite successful. And so it's a Sidney Lumet movie, and I'm playing a CIA or something, or FBI, and I'm testifying, and I say, you know, hey, yes, how'd you know these guys were mobsters, were Italians? I said, you know, walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, chances are it's a duck. So I'm standing on 8th Avenue outside of the Penn Station at one point or something, and this truck rolls by, and a guy leans out the window and says, hey, quacks like a duck. It's like, okay. It's like, you're that guy, right? It's just, you know, the little connections that that people want to make with someone that they saw in a movie or on TV, or, you know, that makes it worthwhile.
All right.
And, well, just the sense that, you know, I was a terrible roofer. So I'm really glad that I found something that I do pretty well.
Exactly. I want to thank you for coming on. What do you have coming up? Any projects coming up?
I just spent quite a bit of time putting together my electronic press kit. Since we came out of the strike, things have not really ramped up. I did a couple episodes of SVU to finish up that character arc, I guess. So, you know, I'm auditioning, looking for the next gig. I think I've got an episode of Power coming out. I don't think that's aired yet. That was shot a long time ago. I just don't think it's aired yet. But people can go on IMDb and check out. I made this fun reel, career retrospective reel, which is fun. Everything from like my first All My Children episode all the way up through, you know, SVU. But just, it's like 3 minutes of my career. It's fun.
So people, go look up Terry Sherber. Go watch all his old shows, you know? You might get some residuals. Yeah. You go, you watch it, you give him a little cash.
Yeah.
Watch his retrospective. People, you can go to my website, coopertalk.net. You can find 998 episodes there. You can email me at cooper@coopertalk.net. Cooper@coopertalk.net. Twitter, I'm at CooperTalk. Instagram, I'm at CooperTalk1. And if you're in the South Jersey or Philly area, March 30th, come to Laughs and Lyrics at Studio 67 in Medford. I'll be doing 20 minutes of stand-up, followed by Nigel Bennett, who played for the Members, an 80s English new wave band. He'll be doing an electric acoustic set for 30 minutes, then we'll do a 20-minute conversation about his time in the music in the 80s, and he's really good friends with Adam Clayton from U2, so it's going to be a great night. You can email me to get details, and that is $20 ahead, and it's BYOB. So once again, check out Terry Serpico. I'm Steve Cooper. I'm only as hip as my guest. Don't forget, drink your water, eat your vegetables, take your vitamins, and I'll talk to you next time.